Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Ladies and gentlemen,
can I please have your attention?
We have a great show for you tonight.
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Jonah Goldberg, host of the Remnant Podcast, brought to you by The Dispatch and Dispatch Media. I am still in Austin. Food still is scarce. Stress is still high. Roads are still impassable. Planes still not taking off. Yesterday, one of the nice things about liberal democratic capitalism is that we come up with better words for contractual arrangements than sort of pejorative criminal ones. And so yesterday, I didn't bribe someone to get me two granola bars for my daughter. I tipped them generously. and so since we're here and everything has been thrown akimbo or cattywampus or off kilter, and we're doing all of this with bearskins and copper wire and one Star Trek tricorder that Spock managed to disassemble. Just so you know, if the audio is weird, that's because we couldn't get certain things to work. And we are literally backing up this conversation on things like iPhones. So, because the last thing I need right now is, in terms of my spare mental bandwidth, to record conversations, no matter how engaging, that only get replayed in the platonic ether. So with that, I am delighted that someone who's actually nearby, but not near enough for me to actually see in person, and a fan favorite of The Remnant, is back. And he is also, can report from the ground, as it were, about the magnificent cockupery of Texas right now. None other than my friend, roving correspondent for National Review, author of many fine books, including his latest, Big White Ghetto, Dead Broke, Stone Cold Stupid, and High on Rage in the Dark Woolly Wilds of the Real America, which might as well be tattooed on my ass right now, given my mood. Kevin Williamson, welcome back to The Remnant.
Well, a couple of thoughts before we get started. One is on the subject of bribery, the Indian concept of bakshish really needs to make its way further into the Western world. Sort of somewhere between a tip and a bribe.
Yeah.
It's neither quite one or the other. I think it's a useful thing to have. Secondly, I sympathize with being stuck in Austin. I got stuck there for 5 years once upon a time and didn't really get much out of it, and neither did they. But it's horrible, and I'm sorry about this, but you know, we both are in Texas. Of course, I live in Texas, but you're the one who's screwed. Where we are, and I mean, it's minor inconveniences, and knock on wood, nothing serious has happened. We had some pipes that got frozen that we could fix with a hairdryer, but our power hasn't gone out, pipes haven't burst yet, none of that kind of stuff. So we've been quite fortunate. Even, in my corner of Dallas, some of the local businesses have opened back up, so you can go buy pizza if you want to, that sort of thing. I'm not having to bribe anyone for a granola bar. Although, because I'm not quite a prepper, but I'm sort of culturally Mormon, I like to say.
Sure, sure.
So when the epidemic started a little over a year ago, we sort of stocked up on, you know, rice and beans and canned food and that kind of stuff. So the interruption in the distribution of goods and services has not had much of an effect on the Williamson household thus far, although it makes you mindful of the fragility of things.
It does. It's I am prone, as is my colleague and our mutual friend David French, I am prone to zombie apocalypse scenario gaming out in my idle time, and my wife and I do a lot of this kind of chatter. Not just zombie apocalypse, but that's just sort of the perfect paradigm for thinking about how you would do all these kinds of things. And it is really interesting. Like, I was saying this on our live event last night. It took our hotel a couple days to decide to do what the Four Seasons and what the Hyatt and these other hotels around here did pretty quickly, which is reserve all of their resources simply for the guests of the hotel and not serve outsiders. And it was really kind of interesting how quickly my brain went from let the market decide to be a good Samaritan to outsiders, get them, you know, why are you here? And there's this, there's this great show that I love called The Expanse that has this scene where this guy is explaining how during times of peace and prosperity, everyone's people are tribal, but the tribes can be very big and very accommodating of strangers and newcomers and all that kind of stuff. But then during times of crisis, tribes get really small, really fast.
Yeah.
And you just stick with your core troop or platoon or whatever it is. And you can just sort of see some of that, you know, on display around here.
Yeah. When I was a little kid and Red Dawn came out, like I was convinced that was my future. That, you know, yeah. I needed to be ready to go up
convinced,
in the
hopeful, you know.
A little bit, yeah. Like we picked out which sporting goods stores we were going to raid and steal their guns and that stuff. And, but we spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, camping in the mountains and, you know, Lubbock is 600 miles away from the mountains. It would have been a miracle to hike that far across the prairie to get there to hide out from the Ruskies. So, in retrospect, you know, that was maybe not the most practical minded emergency preparation scenario, but on the other hand, I was in about fifth grade, I guess. So, yeah, I've maybe thought through some things since then.
Just so you know, David French has has access to a family compound that has its own groundwater, has a large stockpile of weaponry and like a year's worth of food in some sort of cellar. And he's made it clear that if you can make it there, when the, I guess now the Chi-Coms come, that he will provide sanctuary. Not for all of the listeners. That only comes with a full paid membership to Dispatch. But this is just an offer for Kevin right here.
I think David would make really a very entertaining warlord in a post-apocalyptic scenario, you know, because he's kind of a nice guy, but you know, he can do the warlord stuff if he has to.
I think tough but fair would be a good way to describe him.
He would not behead anybody who didn't have it coming, I don't think.
Right.
You know, and actually, in terms of zombie apocalypse planning, I'm as bad as anyone else in Texas not being prepared for winter, which is silly for reasons I'll get into later. But, you know, my escape from Dallas strategy has always been based on the idea that all of the interstates and freeways will be impassable to motor vehicles. But I have a motorcycle that is an off-road motorcycle. So I can get around that stuff, but not in the snow and ice, you can't.
No.
That is a good way to die. So, you know, plan B is the Mini Cooper, which is a lot less of a warlord type vehicle, you know. As I recall in Mad Max, there weren't any roving bands of Mini Cooper drivers pillaging around and stealing everything.
Yeah, although the Jason Bourne movie did more to improve the masculinity of Mini Cooper drivers than any other film before or since, I think. Although there was also a movie, The Italian Job, which was all Mini Coopers too.
So, two versions of The Italian Job. There's the original one back in the 60s with the real Mini Cooper. And then
that's the remake.
I should point out that is my wife's car. I have a much more manly car.
I understand. My wife's car is a Mini Cooper as well, which is why you can tell I am not heaping any disparagement on said vehicle. All right. So, you know a bit about markets, you know a bit about economics, you know a bit about energy, and you live in Texas. Mm. How do you think people should think about the situation on the ground here in Texas and the energy grid stuff?
Yeah, it's like everything else that's wrong in this country, practically, it's a combination of public and private failures. These kinds of winter storms are unusual in Texas, but they are not unprecedented. And so I grew up in the Panhandle, and the kind of weather region I grew up in starts maybe 200 miles west of Dallas and Fort Worth. And we get real winter there. You know, we get storms mm-hmm. with snow drifts that'll go up as high as your roof line, as high as trees. And I can remember sudden blizzards that came in so fast they closed down the Amarillo Highway and that kind of stuff. So that's only a couple hundred miles from Dallas and in the Dallas metro. And so the idea that a winter storm like that couldn't shift 100 miles east and a little bit to the south is wishful thinking. And you're seeing these hilarious news reports. We haven't seen snow like this in Texas since 2009. All right, guys, that's great. I think the temperature picture is something that people really weren't expecting. I mean, snow you can kind of sort of deal with in various ways. In a lot of the cities, you can just ignore it, especially right now because people are already working from home because we got a plague before the storm.
Right.
But the cold was enough that it caused various kinds of equipment failures around the state for things like natural gas wellheads and the equipment that helps pipelines to operate. You know, the pipes themselves don't really freeze through, but some of the stuff can go wrong. Some of the nuclear plants had similar things where the equipment broke down because it was so cold and they had to shut it down. So this is stuff that can be fixed. You can weatherize these things. There are things not every single piece of equipment, no, but there are a lot of things you can do to harden your system to that kind of thing. And it's again, it's an unexpected and an unusual, but by no means unforeseeable circumstance, because everything in our politics is culture war. Everyone's fighting about windmills right now and how big a piece the windmill picture is. And I just posted on this at National Review. There's kind of a silly headline in the New York Times that says, "No, wind turbines are not the main source of Texas's power failures." Well, of course they're not. They only make up about 7% of the power mix at this time of year anyway. So even if 100% of them went down, which close to 100% of them did go down, 98%, one person told me, although I have not independently confirmed that, still, that's not a huge piece overall if you get a large amount of that wind power going offline. But it does account for, according to the state agency or the nonprofit corporation, I guess, that manages the electrical grid, the renewables that have gone offline account for about 40% of the missing power. So they are certainly disproportionately represented in that. There are wind turbines that provide reliable power all over the world, including places that get reasonably cold, like Western Europe and Scandinavia. But they are built differently from ours. They've got, essentially winter countermeasures built into them that we haven't done. And these are choices that people make. You can choose to build one way, you can choose to build the other way. And I think this kind of presents us with an interesting kind of dilemma of orientation for conservatives. Because some people say conservative and they mean penny pinching. We don't want to spend any more on this than we have to. Some people say conservative and we mean risk averse. We want to prepare for things that are going to happen. Winter is coming, as the Game of Thrones teaches us. And I'm more and more, as I get older, on the risk averse rather than penny pinching end of thing. And I think the penny pinching actually can be a form of risk aversion. We don't want to spend too much money because we'd like to have flexibility in the face of unforeseen circumstances. And we'd like to make sure that our resources aren't automatically all taken up and not able to be redeployed for some other end, which is one of the things that really worries me about, you know, the federal debt and the annual deficit. And so we spent a lot of money subsidizing renewables. And I'm glad renewables are there. I like wind power. I like solar power. I don't like subsidies for anything, essentially. And I think that things ought to be built to the extent that the market will support it, because that is how you make the best use of the resources you actually have. But none of this, I think, really breaks down along any lines that provide anyone with an ideologically satisfying narrative. This is not just a failure of government regulation. It's not just a failure of private enterprise. It's actually a really good example of corporatism, you know, something that you've written about a lot. So in Texas, we've got the Reliability Council, which I'm sure they wish they had a different name right now. You know, kind of, sort of reliability most of the time, Council. And so they are a nonprofit private corporation that operates most of the state electrical grid. The utilities are generally private companies. In some places, people have a choice between providers, but it's kind of an illusory choice, because whether you choose A or B, your electricity comes over the same wires and your gas comes over through the same pipes. They are, of course, so heavily regulated that they act essentially like government agencies. You know, you're not really a private business if you can't raise your prices without the state's permission, and utilities generally can't do that. So it's a weird mix of things that unfortunately is the model for what a lot of people want to see in the rest of the economy in very sensitive things like healthcare, where they want to have insurance companies and providers and such regulated to such an extent that they act more or less like utilities, that they have to provide service and pricing in the same way utilities do, in a way that is fixed according to certain political criteria. And you're going to end up getting the same results. You know, it's funny because I'm kind of a, you know, off the wall libertarian in a lot of ways, but I think that we free market types don't do ourselves any favors by pretending that simply saying, well, markets will work, capitalism will take care of it, and let businesses off the leash to do what they will, is going to solve all the problems, because it won't. The reason you don't have 25 different competing gas providers to people's homes with 25 different competing networks is not policy. It's the fact that it's not practical to put 25 different pipes in people's houses and to build a new network every time you start a new company and take the old one out every time someone goes bankrupt or merges or something. So these are, you know, questions of practical physical reality that I think have to be taken into account, at least.
So I'm with you. I mean, I'm more of the risk averse. You know, one of my favorite definitions of conservatism is the Abraham Lincoln, what is conservatism if not reliance on the old and tried versus the new and untried? You know, so there's a lot of wisdom in that. And I agree with you about the wind stuff. I mean, like, some of the stuff that your governor was saying on Fox was sort of just real boob bait nonsense. And
we are, all of us in the Republican states are governed by Fox News now.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, we can talk about that in a second, but the idea that, I mean, sort of as you were pointing out, I was trying to explain this to my daughter, here, it was like, cause she heard me talking about the wind stuff. And, you know, and the way I explain it is like in DC with traffic, and I'm sure it's the same principle in every big city. If the traffic is 10% lighter, all the cars can move basically at the maximum legal speed. If the traffic is just 5% heavier than full, you know, than maximum capacity, everything can grind to a standstill. The differences are always at that thing at the margins for this kind of stuff. And if you pull, as you say, 40, I didn't know that number, but that the 40% of the stuff that's out is wind, that's a significant thing. But the stuff that I think is the thing that annoyed me the most in this public policy argument was the stuff that Rick Perry was saying yesterday, I guess, where he said, you know, Texans would rather tough it out in the cold and be part, that take help from the federal government on their on energy policy or something. And yeah, like 20 something people have already died. There are people who have been without power for 30 hours. And the idea that like the Texas grid isn't part of some sort of federal scheme anyway is sort of silly. And he has to know that. He was the energy secretary. And the thing that bothers me about it is the reason why people like you and me talk about how we should use markets and markets are better, and not markets aren't perfect, but markets are better and the free market works better, isn't that it's like this yeehaw, it's our culture argument, although I think it is part of our culture. It's that it's just a practical point of view, is that like it works better than centralized planning. And but there are times like during a pandemic, and we've talked about this before, where you need more centralization than you normally would tolerate because of the nature of the crisis that you're facing. And for Rick Perry to sort of double down on the yee-haw rather than just sort of say, let's figure out how to work the problem, I just think it's just, it's sort of a foxification of what should be an intelligent conversation at a time of pretty serious emergency for a lot of people.
Yeah, and that's particularly disappointing in the case of Perry, who actually knows a lot about this stuff and is a pretty smart guy.
You're a fan of.
Have been in the past. Doubling down on yeehaw has pretty much been his strategy for the last, five, six, 8 years, maybe. And for a little bit there, around the 2016 primary, it looked like he was going to go the opposite direction. You know, he stopped wearing cowboy boots everywhere, that sort of thing. Stopped exaggerating his accent, which for some reason Texas politicians do. Little pet peeve of mine, George W. Bush is from Midland, which is one town south from Lubbock. I've never in my life heard anyone with that accent. I have no idea where it comes from, but it sure as hell doesn't come from Midland, Texas.
That's sort of like Sarah Palin's accent in Alaska. It's very hard to find someone else who talks like Sarah Palin. She sounds more like a native, I mean, like a Native American indigenous than she does an Alaskan from Wasilla. But anyway.
Really? Huh. Yeah. I don't know much about Alaskan accents. I know a lot about Texas accents because I actually studied in school down there in Austin. That was a real useful application of my time. But I think that one of the really lamentable things about where we are politically, and I don't want to tread too much on this because it's probably too familiar ground between us at this point, but it's the conversion of everything into culture war politics. So we've got a question here about some technical issues, including how the Texas electrical grid is built and its relationship to the grid in the rest of the country, and the reason why it's difficult for Texas to import electricity from the outside. We've got questions about decisions that were made about winterizing equipment in a bunch of different industries that are all kind of related. We've got a problem of correlated risk, which is that an unusually cold period like this not only interferes with electricity production, but it also greatly increases the demand for it at the same time, which is not what you want. You want risks that offset one another rather than risks that all move in the same direction. But what we have to do instead is have this yeehaw fight about, well, it's those goddamn windmills out there.
Yeah.
Or no, it's not those goddamn windmills out there. It's you and your natural gas.
Right.
When none of these things actually sheds any real light on the situation, none of them is going to produce any policy ideas that are going to be constructive. And I suppose it's probably partly related to the complexity of a society that is as technologically sophisticated as ours is. But most of the useful conversations increasingly are only happening among specialists in highly technical areas. So, I've had some conversations with people about, hey, what's up with the situation in Texas? Why is our grid this way? Why are we having these problems? And they can explain this stuff to a non-specialist at a relatively superficial level. But the long-term questions about, well, how could we make better investment decisions about preparing this stuff for a situation like this versus all the other things we might do with that money, which also are good and desirable, is a very, very difficult question to answer if you're a New York Times columnist or a National Review columnist or someone who wants to try to fit these things into a red state versus blue state, us versus them, real America versus the coastal elites. It's just useless. It's a sterile and intellectually tail-chasing way of approaching the world. But increasingly, it's a near monopoly on our political discourse.
Yeah. And I got to say, you were ahead of me on some of this. I mean, let me put it this way, you gave free rein to your inner Mencken earlier than I did in our relative comparative careers. And, you know, people keep asking me, what has changed about your views since Trump and blah, 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 blah. And obviously I had my criticisms of boneheads on the right, you know, all along, and he's getting into fights with the stupid racists and all that kind of thing. But there's this psychological mechanism that I lost in the last 5 years, which is this sort of de facto assumption that my team is better. Mm-hmm. And it drives you. I mean, I could always overcome it when I thought necessary, but the times when I thought necessary were just fewer and more far between than they are now, because I just don't have that default kind of like, let me find the reason why we're right. Mm-hmm. You know, orientation that used to drive a lot of stuff I did. And I'm not rejecting all of that or any of that kind of stuff. I'm just saying that it was a source of, it was a muse in a way. Yeah. And you can see it in a lot of our friends and colleagues on the right, who I think it explains a big chunk of the rush to the whataboutism stuff, is that if you have to defend your own side and there is no good intellectually coherent defense of it, you just cast about for the next best thing, which is to say the other side is a hypocrite, because look what they said, or look what they did, or look at the violence that they endorsed. Yeah. And since I haven't become Max Boot or Jen Rubin or something like that, I think that side kind of sucks too.
Yeah.
And so it's very liberating, but it also just feels kind of homeless-y. And you were better at spotting the buffoonery on the right than I was earlier than I was. Although I think we would both agree the buffoonery wasn't as pronounced 10 or 15 years ago than it is today.
Yeah, it's become worse. I think when it comes to defensiveness of the Republican Party, in particular Republican politicians, the calculus that maybe I used to do and maybe you used to do was that there are compromises you make in order to pursue practical political goals that are good, and right, that this trade-off is worth it. And I think that's where I disagree with some of the less abject Trumpists. You know, who are like, yes, we understand this is not an ideal situation, but we want to get X, Y, and Z done, and this is the way to get it done. And so we're not going to acknowledge things that we know to be problems. We're not going to be as rigorous in our criticism as we could or should be for reasons of political calculation. And I've come to the opinion, I think, that that's a miscalculation, that conservatives are no longer getting enough out of the Republican Party and Republican elected officials to be quite so intellectually, morally, and politically indulgent as we have been for a long time. And I mean, that's been my main criticism of the conservative movement for as long as I can remember, is that it's too self-consciously associated with and subordinate to the Republican Party rather than the other way around. Mm-hmm. The Republican Party ought to be considered an instrument and a tool rather than something that we owe obedience to or fealty to in some way. So I do think that's a problem. Although I think, and not to one-up you on this, but my main takeaway from the Trump years hasn't been so much a lower opinion of the Republican Party or the broader conservative movement. It's really a lower opinion of the American people. Mm-hmm. Because the Trump stuff, I mean, again, not to engage in whataboutism. And I remember after the riot at the Capitol, every talk radio show in this country the next day, well, the real story here is the media. Well, no, it's not. The real story here is the ransacking of the Capitol. But you have analogous energies and movements on the other side. Bernie Sanders' movement is a lot like the Donald Trump movement, both intellectually and practically. And they're not that far apart in views either. You know, anti-trade, anti-immigration, stuff. They talk about it differently, but it's a lot of the same kind of populist horse bucky applied to the same ends for the same reasons. And I think that our problem is that Americans are intellectually and morally exhausted. We don't know where to go. We don't understand why we're unhappy. And to the extent that we do understand why we're unhappy, we're unwilling to do the things that would change that. We're rich enough that we haven't yet really had to make a lot of hard choices. And but we're not so rich that we can completely ignore the consequences of refusing to make those hard choices. So we're always in that situation of simultaneously having too much and too little at the same time. And we have too much in the sense that we don't have a real spur to reform and intelligent action, but too little to get away with it. I used to know these people, when I was editing a newspaper on the main line, which is this old blue blood, old money community. I knew a lot of these kids who had trust funds. I mean, kids, they're in their late 20s, early 30s. And a lot of them had the same situation where they had trust funds that were big enough so they didn't really have to work or anything, but they didn't have trust funds that were so big that they were like rich. Mm-hmm. So they essentially were people in their 35, 36, 37 who were living on a kind of college undergraduate standard of living. Now, they didn't have to work or do anything to do that, and they didn't know what the rent on their apartments was because they never paid it, but they weren't satisfied with where they were in life. They had too much and too little at the same time. And I think that's true of us nationally. We're the trust fund kid of nations.
I think there's a lot to that. I mean, I hate giving credit, too much credit to Richard Hofstadter on this kind of stuff. But I think status class anxiety is a big thing that it's not so much resentment of what you have, it's about how little you have or how you want more. It's the feeling that you deserve more than the person who has slightly more than you has, or yes, that you perceive to have slightly more than you, that drives a lot of problems out there. And I'm with you on disappointment in the American people. One of the questions we get all the time here is, okay, so you like strong parties and smoke-filled rooms, and you want to get rid of bad. Yeah, I know. I mean, you're on Team Smoke-Filled Room too, I'm constantly railing about how Matt Gaetz is the symbol of literally everything that is wrong in American politics. Mm-hmm. But the question with those guys is, how do you fix it? And one of the core problems is that there's a market for this crap, and that market comes from the American people. And it comes from, both sidesism gets a bad rap sometimes sometimes it deserves it because there is an asymmetry between both sides, but there are common problems between both sides. And there's also a problem of the people in the middle of those both sides that just don't care enough to provide the incentive structure and the market signals for politicians to respond to. I mean, if the American people tomorrow said, we're no longer going to reward stupidity, cravenness, and BS, a lot of businesses that we are aware of would go out of business, and a lot of politicians would see their careers, dry up and blow away. But the market isn't, the audience is not demanding that.
Yeah, it's, there's a reason that, Sean Hannity's trouble in life right now is that he may have misused his private plane. And that my trouble in life is not that. Not that I have a lot of serious troubles in life. But the unfortunate thing about this is that people, particularly conservatives, I think, they want to be told how to fix stuff. They want to be told, here's a solution you can believe in. Which is why you get these single issue fanatics like fair tax guys. Like, they're a cult. I mean, I love them. They're nice guys, but it's a cult. And there's no problem fair tax can't fix. And I've had these guys.
Gold standards, another one.
Gold standards, a big one. Yeah, nope. Getting rid of fiat currency and fractional reserve banking and all that kind of stuff. But it's just not the case. And a lot of conservatives say, well, if we could only fix education in the universities, or if we could only fix media bias, then all these problems would go away. Because that's a really comforting story to tell yourself, because that story essentially is that the American people don't really have a problem. They've just been misled, brainwashed, whatever, into wanting things that aren't good for them and to not supporting the policies that we support, which obviously would be good for everybody. And that's just simply not true. The American people are not victims of propaganda. They are eager, active consumers of propaganda. And I think you're right here that in this case, the demand preceded the supply. by a great deal. Even if you look at the late Rush Limbaugh, and you look at the trajectory of his career and the way in which he conducted his program, that kind of nakedly propagandistic, subordinate, terrified of the audience, terrified of the movement and voters way of looking at the world became much, much more pronounced over the years. Rush, at the end of his career, was not very much like the Rush of the 1990s. And you see this on the right a lot, you see it on the left a lot, where the New York Times is so buffaloed by its subscribers, which are overwhelmingly well to the left of center of American politics, that it's terrified of not responding when they start calling for the head of some employee over some weird taboo cultural transgression. And that of course is true on the right as well, where you can tell that Fox is just terrified of its audience. You can tell that Fox News, or talk radio rather, is just terrified of their audience. And that if they don't stay out in front of that parade, then they're going to lose their position. And of course, these guys have a lot more to lose than people like me do. I would hate if I lost my job and had to go do something else for a living. But, losing $40 or $50 million a year is a very different kind of proposition. And I like to think that I have such great integrity and such that I couldn't be swayed by such considerations. But I'm not sure that's true. I think that if I had, a tens of millions dollar a year contract on the line, I probably would feel that kind of intellectual pressure much, much more acutely than I do. In my particular situation, it's relatively easy to resist this stuff because National Review is kind of a boutique. And it's not one that is particularly immediately beholden to kind of quarterly reports and things that you have to do if you're a regular for-profit publicly held corporation. So I'm in a pretty lucky position, but it's not the same for people who are in talk radio and cable news and things like that. I do worry that people can't see this, though. For me, I look at Newsmax or something, and when I hear something from Newsmax, even their commercials, I don't hear political propaganda. I hear a business plan being executed. And these people are saying, all right, there are dopes out there. They've got money. Let's take the money of these dopes. And here's how you do it. It's like, I mentioned this before. I went to this Flat Earth convention about a year and a half ago. And you could really tell, who was selling a product and who was a true believer. And so many of these guys are just so nakedly selling a product. But I think the people who consume this stuff don't care. They don't mind being lied to so long as they are lied to in a skillful and entertaining way. I think of, all the praise that Bill Clinton got back in the 90s for being slick, as they said. Democrats loved him for it. They loved his dishonesty because he was good at it. And they thought it made Republicans look like jackasses, which it often did. But if you've got to the point where people want to be lied to, then it's a very difficult place, I think, politically to recover from.
Yeah, no, I wanted to get to Rush, and we can come back to him in a second. But this is one of my enduring obsessions is the treatment of politics as a form of entertainment, and I think kayfabe, this concept from professional wrestling where it's supposed to seem like a genuine event that breaks the fourth wall from within the stagedness of wrestling and people debate. Was that scripted, or were they really angry with each other? That kind of thing, that weird verite dramatic tension that you can't quite decide. Is it a happening, or is it a narrative? That's what people crave all over the place. I thought the most telling, almost. I mean, it was so perfect that it was almost the kind of treacle you would expect from an Aaron Sorkin script when, what's his name? Crazy conspiracy, InfoWars guy.
Alex Jones?
When Alex Jones's lawyers filed in court saying that they could not be held accountable because they were entertainers and this was not in no way a journalistic enterprise. I mean, I bet if you talk to 100 devoted followers of InfoWars, you would have the kind of conversation you would have would be very similar to the kind of conversation you have with real, at least the professional wrestling obsessives I used to be friends with, where they say, yeah, I know it's fake, but, you know, and there would always be this sort of wanting it both ways, dancing in and out, using the fictionalized stuff to explain away the stuff that you don't like, and then saying, but the stuff I do like, you know, there's something really, here's the backstory here, here's what's really going on. It just gives you the maximum range of psychological imaginary, you know, transcendental imagination to describe the reality of the way you want it to. And that's going more, that sort of stuff is just leaking into vast swaths of quote unquote mainstream media.
Yeah, I think it's a variation on your clown nose on, clown nose off model.
On the Rush thing, someone asked, we did this live event thing for subscribers last night, and one of the questions that came in was, who is more influential on the conservative movement or the Republican Party? I can't remember the exact phrasing. William F. Buckley or Rush Limbaugh? And alas, the question didn't go to me because Sarah Isger is mean and didn't want to ask me. Steve said Rush Limbaugh indisputably. And he made a good case for it in terms of Limbaugh's relevance in the 1990s pre-Fox. And sort of like before, you're saying everybody in Red State is basically governed by Fox. There was a certain amount of like before that, they were governed by Rush aspect. Though the Republican Party was not, there were a lot of adults still in the Republican Party in the 1990s, I think. But if I had to answer it, I don't think I would have said Rush, because I don't think the Republican Party would be the conservative party were it not for William F. Buckley. The Republican Party's turn to populism, I think, is both a big chunk is Rush's doing, but also it's difficult to say that because it's also Rush was simply a manifestation of the same phenomenon that happened to the GOP. But how would you slice all that up?
I think from the founding of National Review until about 1994, Newt Gingrich, Bill and National Review style conservatism were unquestionably the predominant intellectual force in American conservatism. The kind of populism that Fox News and Donald Trump and Rush and such channel is something that's been a part of American politics since Jackson. And it shows up in both parties. It shows up in different ideological orientations. You know, it was George Wallace, it was Huey Long, it was Pat Buchanan, it was Ross Perot. A lot of very different kind of figures in terms of their policy views and their kind of cultural resonance, but they all kind of came from the same energy. I think from 94 through now, I think it's unquestionable that that Rush was the bigger influence. At the risk of sounding uncharitable, I would say that of the things that we like about the conservative movement and the Republican Party, Bill is much more responsible for, and the things I don't like about them, Rush is much more responsible for. I never had any personal relationship with Rush Limbaugh. He used to read my stuff on the air a lot and not always being too scrupulous about crediting me, although generally doing so. And I think that as a matter of practical politics, obviously you have to do things like win elections, and you have to therefore have some kind of popular appeal. You know, there's a reason why National Review, largest magazine of its kind, you know, our traffic is not a rounding error on Pornhub, you know, or something like that. This is where people's attention really is. If you add up all of the ideological, partisan, highbrow political media together, you know, you would not add up to the audience of The Bachelor or 10% of it. So, you know, what we do as kind of pointy-headed right-wing pundits is try to exercise some influence and in some cases intellectual leadership over a relatively small number of people. Now, those people matter. They're, you know, Hayek's secondhand dealers in ideas. They're not, you know, the great vast masses. They're not the isolated geniuses in their garages. They're the people who are kind of in between that, who are business leaders and academics and media figures and cultural leaders of various kinds. And it matters what they think. And it matters where their cultural affiliations lie. Unfortunately, where we are right now with the populace really having the upper hand, and not only the upper hand, but really almost uncontested control, is that it's very difficult for the more intellectual strain of conservatism to reach out to the kind of people that we want to try to connect with and influence. It's one thing to criticize university administrations. It's another thing just to accept that they're a lost cause, they're an enemy of the people, and to treat them as, you know, a threat to national security, which is kind of how we talk about it now. You know, we've gone in a relatively short period of time from criticizing the excesses of the NEA to essentially writing off the idea of art, you know, and sneering at these people who drink wine and have art on their walls and eat cheese. All right, you know, maybe they don't represent the masses of new Soviet American man, but, you know, they're part of the system too. And so Republicans have really embraced this identity of being the farmer labor party. And I don't think that there's really much political future in it. I think that the appeal of this kind of populism is wide, but it's not wide enough to really carry a movement on its own. And it's certainly not intellectually rigorous enough to carry that movement in any particular direction in any kind of focused and organized way. So you need both things, obviously, to have a movement that exercises practical political influence. But I think that in pursuing election wins at the cost of everything else, including intellectual integrity, we've created a situation in which we ensure that it's going to be a very long time before we win elections or have that kind of intellectual standing again.
Alas, I think that is correct. Since I have you here, when we're doing, and we're both in Texas, let's return to the Lone Star State for a second. I'm a big fan of Texas. It took me I know you do this thing with Charlie, but I gotta say, like, forced to choose between Florida culture and Texas culture, I choose Texas every time. And frankly, neither place is hospitable in the summer, as far as I'm concerned. So I'd probably choose Texas climate too. But I'm not a big fan of, and I refer to it as the yeehaw thing, like the guys who overcompensate with the cowboy hats and the boots. I mean, it's one thing if you work on a ranch, wear what you want to wear, you know, whatever. I mean, I'm fine with it at the margins, but there are people who really go overboard with some of it that I just kind of leaves me cold. And I know a lot of very successful Texans, and they're proud Texans. They like Texas, but they don't go all in on all that stuff. They certainly, to the extent they wear cowboy boots and have bolo ties, it's an afterthought. It's not like a huge identity signifier kind of thing. But what I don't understand is, like, I normally have this general view that powerlessness yields a lot of stupidity and extremism. And, you know, there's this thing, particularly on the intellectual left, that there's some great nobility and powerlessness, and that you should always side with the powerless against the powerful, and which is just utter ridiculousness, because sometimes the people with power deserve to have the power, and the people who are powerless deserve not to have power, and you have to make distinctions.
They don't.
Yeah, I mean, if power just simply made you evil, then God is the devil, right?
Isn't that a Pixie song?
It may not. It may well be. But so Texas has been run by Republicans for a very long time, and the Republicans I know in Texas are very reasonable, smart people. I mean, they're very free market and they're very, you know, capitalistic and all that kind of stuff. So what explains like Alan West and these yachts talking about secessionism and going all this way? And it's one thing for the GOP of Portland or of Oregon to do this, right? Because I mean, like the only people who are willing to take the slings and arrows of being members of the Republican Party of Oregon are going to be some kind of wackadoo, you know, CPAC basement types.
Yeah.
But like Texas is the Republican Party is where the power is in Texas. Yeah. And yet it's trafficking in this craziness. What explains it?
Yeah, you know, you just reminded me of something I've said for a long time, that if somebody really wants to be an American hero, what someone needs to do is be the guy who takes one for the team and goes and actually rebuilds the Republican Party in California.
Yeah.
Which is something that needs to be done and hasn't been done. So I think I have a kind of cultural explanation of that, because as you know, I grew up here and I grew up in, you know, what we like to think of as the real Texas, you know, in West Texas. It's not like Austin or Houston or Dallas. You know, it's cotton farmers and actual cowboys and such, although that's not my life. My read on this is that this kind of weird, cancerous, mutant, metastatic Texasism is something that has grown up alongside the urbanization of the state and the end of the rural agricultural culture and mode of life to which that cowboy thing refers. So the fewer actual cowboys there are, the more pretend cowboys there are, the fewer actual farmers there are, the more, you know, kind of good old boy stuff. You have not ever been to my house, not in spite of an invitation, by the way, maybe next time you're in town. But I live in this part of town that, it looks a little like San Francisco. It's not row houses like that, but it's old houses on very narrow lots, mostly without garages and that sort of thing. Cause it was built in an era when that's how housing was built. And, you know, you've got these guys here, these, you know, F-350 trucks in front of their houses with dually wheels and all that kind of stuff. They are not towing around horse trailers on the weekend. They're not, you know. And, of course, these are the guys who were in the 135-car pileup a couple of days ago in Fort Worth. You know, even in the 70s, which I remember pretty well, when you think about Texas country music in the 70s, it wasn't this, you know, kind of white hat, fake cowboy thing. It was, you know, sort of hippies like Willie Nelson or sort of, you know, lounge singer types like Terry Allen. There wasn't this kind of, I mean, there's always been talk about secession. It was always kind of a joke for the most part, and sometimes it still is. Although I think it's taken on a more serious political resonance than it once had, especially among kooks. But the whole kind of, I'm a good old boy, I drive a truck, I wear boots, I wear a hat. And I own a lot of hats, and I own a lot of pair of boots. I don't own a truck, but I do like them. And, but that as a kind of ersatz cultural identity is a really weird thing. So we've taken essentially a kind of fashion and made a fake identity out of it, because we don't know what else to believe in. Because the truth is about Texas, it's not that unusual a place. You know, Dallas is a lot like Atlanta. Houston is a lot like Los Angeles. El Paso is a lot like Tucson. These places have a lot in common. Big cities all around the country are a lot alike. Ex-urban areas around the country are a lot alike. Agricultural areas around the country are a lot alike. You know, when I go, I've been to farms in South Dakota and Ohio. They're a lot like farms in Texas. That's just how those things go. Cattle ranches in California are a lot like cattle ranches in Texas. Big cities in New York are a lot like big cities in Texas. And so that distinctiveness that Texans have always prided ourselves on isn't really there in any kind of very obvious way. And to the extent it is, it's often things that we now resent or recoil from. For instance, the existence of a kind of hybrid border culture along the Texas-Mexico border. You know, I know people in the panhandle who really resent when they see billboards in Spanish along the side of the highway. And they think this means something bad for them culturally, something's gone wrong. But I don't think that's really the case in places like El Paso, where, which is not that far away, but where they've really had a kind of hybrid border culture and they're used to Spanish-speaking people, and have had Spanish-speaking people around for as long as there've been people there, or as long as there've been non-Indian people there. So it's weird to be a state whose identity is so historically tied to being a border state in many ways and having close relations with Mexico, but is so anti-immigrant, and particularly so anti-Spanish-speaking immigrant. And that is so tied up in this agricultural small town mode of life that hasn't really been the dominant way of life in Texas in probably 100 years, maybe more.
So that's really interesting. I want to see what you think about, maybe I asked you about this before, and I don't think this was some grand private thing that she told me, but our friend Virginia Postrel, I think she was the first one to say this to me, and I've asked Texans about this, particularly Dallas. What do you say? What's the word for people from Dallas? Dallasites?
Yeah.
Dallasians? Daleks?
Yuppies.
That, you know, anyway, Virginia once said, because she had moved to Dallas years ago, and she said, the thing about Washington, the thing about New York, the thing about LA is that money matters, but really the main currency for status is status, celebrity of some sort, right? In Washington, it's access to politics and that kind of thing. LA, it's basically celebrity. In New York, what's unique about it is that you actually have a nexus of several different trend lines of celebrity, money, power, status, all that kind of stuff. But she said one of the nice things about Dallas, if you're of a certain philosophical point of view, is that among elites, it's just money. Like if you make, if you're an immigrant off the boat and you make $50 million a year because you started a wire hanger factory, then you have as much prominence as the guy who has $50 million a year from 10 car dealerships, whose family has been here for 100 years or whatever. And for people like you and me, this is a great example of the democratizing power of money, you know, that it cuts off all of these sort of old ethnic, religious, identity politics things and measures people by one metric, one interpretation of one narrow metric of merit. And obviously it has drawbacks, but there's also benefits to it. And that's one of the things I like about Texas is this practicality thing, that it is less ideologically suffused, and which is why I find like the Rick Perry thing so stupid, is that there's the kind of Texan-ness I like is this can do, you know, cut the BS, let's just solve the problem kind of thing that you get in Texans. And I suspect you probably got in Californians 50 or 100 years ago. But the thing that, all right, so I want to ask you about this is a very narrow question, but I was stunned. You know, you talk about how Texas is urbanizing and it's becoming a, you know, cosmopolitan place and all that. You can definitely see it in Austin, although maybe not the last few days. And so when this thing hit and all of a sudden all the restaurants started closing before our eyes and all that, I would have expected that instantaneously this would be the moment for the food truck industry here. This is supposed to be the food truck capital of America in a lot of ways, right? And in New York, as you know, 5 minutes into a blackout, the streets are swarming, mostly with African migrants, but whatever, selling flashlights for $25 a piece.
Yes.
And the second it rains, they're selling umbrellas. And that's true in a lot of places in Europe too. And anyway, so like, I've seen 0.0, I've seen a lot of good Samaritans helping each other out. That's great, fine. I've seen 0.0 entrepreneurialism in town amidst all of this. To me, it's kind of fascinating. I've driven past parking lots full of food trucks. And I've talked to staff here. It's like walking around downtown Austin, you know, I'm just off Congress Street. I'm like the Congress Bridge is right over my shoulder. Congress Avenue Bridge. A pizza truck that stopped in front of this parked in front of this hotel, and they would let it park in the driveway, would sell out in 2 hours, and they could charge, they could price gouge, which we both don't really believe price gouging is a thing, very easily. And see, I've just seen zero of that. I mean, should I be surprised by that?
Well, remember that you're seeing this on top of the coronavirus shutdown. So there's been a lot of disinvestment from services. A lot of those restaurants were going to be either limited or closed to start with. And they've had practice being out of business for a few days. So a lot of people are doing the math, I think, that says in terms of risk and reward, it's just not worth it to me. But yeah, I do think if in Austin, if you were delivering pizzas and it was a $100 delivery charge, you would sell some pizza still.
In this hotel alone, there are families who moved in here because they lost power at home.
Yeah.
And so there are a lot of sort of, you know, Austinite refugees with their dogs and babies and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They pay through the nose. I would have paid through the nose. And it's just very interesting to me that, you know, I think you would get this in DC or Milwaukee.
I know there are people here in Dallas who rented hotel rooms, even though their power's not out, just in case, you know, because it's a relatively low cost hedge. And, which I'm sure makes them unpopular among people who currently can't rent hotel rooms because they're all filled up. Yeah, I think that also goes back to the thing of having too much and too little at the same time, where there's just not the kind of spur to do that stuff for people that there maybe ought to be. And partly that's a cultural change where instead of admiring the moxie and the opportunism, we look at them as, you know, being somehow vulgar, profiteers, price gougers, that sort of thing. And something that's very hard for Americans to talk about because we don't like to talk about the real inequality in our society. But this is one of the many ways in which rich Americans subsidize poor Americans. So if you really had a kind of culture and environment where in a situation like this, you could just sort of go all out and say, yes, we'll sell you gasoline, but it's $60 a gallon or whatever. There are people who pay that, and that gets the market moving, they get supplies moving, and that helps prices get back to where they need to be into a more normal place. Instead, you've got this sort of shutdown where, you know, there are people who have money, so they're prepared for these kinds of things because they're always prepared for things because that's one of the nice things about having money. There are people who live paycheck to paycheck who can't prepare for these kinds of things. And so, you know, the people who are very well off are not really being made terribly uncomfortable by the coronavirus shutdown, and they're not being made terribly uncomfortable by the storm unless, you know, their power's been interrupted or something like that. And of course, the really wealthy people have their own backup power and all that stuff too. So they don't really have a spur. There's maybe not as much opportunity to sell them things as you could. But yeah, that does kind of surprise me though, that I know the part of Austin you're talking about, and there are a lot of hotels around there. And even with what's going on the roads out there, getting a food truck from one to the next and selling tacos for $60 a piece all day would be a completely feasible business model.
Yeah, I mean, I have been surprised. You know, as you know, my wife's from Alaska, so she she has very strong opinions about a few things, and one of them is she has utter contempt for DC drivers in snowstorms, and they don't know how to drive in snow. I got to say, like, and I will, points for honesty to the Texans, because I've been talking about this on Twitter, and all the Texans admit, every Texan here I've talked to admits none of them know how to drive on ice and snow. Okay, and yeah. I've seen two nights ago, I saw two cops in one of those weird sort of downtown, almost like a beach buggy golf cart kind of thing, take a turn so sharp that they nearly died, and died by crashing into pedestrians on the street. And these are cops. I mean, like, just like it's, and one of the things that's really kind of fascinating is all these dudes with these pickup trucks. And I always thought the point of owning a pickup truck was to be able, because growing up in a place like New York and living in DC, I don't have a lot of stuff to haul, but like, I see the value of having a pickup truck because of the ability to drive in bad conditions and that kind of stuff. But as my wife explained to me, which makes total sense, lots of people get pickup trucks that only have rear wheel power. And so, which I gather has advantages in certain circumstances. I'm not a car guy, but like, and this is why my wife has all these stories about how when they had a very steep driveway in their place in Fairbanks, my mother-in-law would put all the kids in the trunk to wait down the back of the car to get it up the driveway.
Right. Yeah.
But all these pickup trucks, I've seen them all over town. They don't have any weight in the back. And so they're flooring it. Yeah. And I can't remember last time I saw people actually burn rubber on ice and not moving a bit. And it's just, it's very nerve wracking driving around with your kid. And anyway,
Burning rubber on ice is going to be the name of my next album.
but there are people with serious vehicles here who could tow a food truck someplace, you know, and presumably some of these people have a warehouse unit with food supplies that they could use. And it, before this hotel, I'm in the line, you know, hotel, before they closed the coffee shop to outsiders, or as I like to call them, outside scum, the line for, no offense to these guys, I mean, they're running low on supplies, not great coffee, was about 90 minutes. And like, you could have a coffee truck that would, anyway, it just, I just think it's really kind of interesting that's not happening. And I would have at least expected it from, like in DC, I live in a ritzy neighborhood. We brought down the average age and household income on our block by about 50% when we moved on it. We're one of the only houses that doesn't automatically have our driveway shoveled from snow and all that kind of stuff. There are people who have these services where the people come out instantaneously. And then the other people hire these like immigrant guys, these Mexicans with a truck who will do it. I haven't seen much of that either. I mean, just yeah. Like, it surprised me is all I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. You just made me think of something that's kind of a tangent, but something that I find interesting, which is the idea.
Unlike all of the incredibly pertinent stuff I was just talking about.
The idea of outsiders. I was just reading a book that's a history of the Comanche. And the Comanche's name for themselves in their own language isn't Comanche. It's a different word. And it just means people. And the word Comanche comes from the language of a neighboring tribe, and it means enemies. but apparently, and I'm no expert on Native American languages, but according to this book I've been reading, that's actually a really common naming convention among Native American tribes, that you call yourselves the people, and your word for the people in the tribe next door are enemies or outsiders or the others or, you know, some particular aspect of them. As I understand, that's the case with Mongolian language, that the word for Mongolian people in Mongolian just means the people. And I think that's maybe a deeply imprinted natural tendency of ours. You're talking about the need for, or the pressing energy for much smaller tribes during times of crisis. And I'm increasingly of the mind that these aspects of human nature are really, really hard to get over and can't be overcome with good government and policy changes, education, political culture, those things. We can mitigate some of those effects, but people, I think, will naturally revert to that state.
Yeah, no, I think it's part of our programming. And you can see little, so since we're doing this tangent, a few years ago, my family and I, we listened to an episode of Radiolab that back before it got really bad, that focused, I can't remember what sparked the story, but it focused, one segment of it focused on a skull from like a Paleolithic, you know, some really old skull of a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old. And it had talon marks on the inside of its eye sockets. And they talked about how there used to be these birds that had like these 12-foot wingspans that would pick up small children and carry them away and feed them to their young, which is sucks. And you know, before that they did it with monkeys and all that kind of stuff. And someone in it said, you know, that weird shiver you get when a shadow goes over your head sometimes that just makes you feel uncomfortable, that is some part of your lizard brain warning you that there could be something with talons about to pick you up by your eye sockets. And I think in those terms all
so is
the
that
time
your, about, your version of what you use in your conversations with your daughter of your children starving in China You could be spooked like up that. By a bird and have your eyeballs pulled out. Not complaining.
But I'm constantly on the lookout in my daydreaming states for these little cues from our prehistoric selves, mm-hmm. trying to poke themselves up, stick their head up into our brains. And that totally deplorable, unredeeming feeling of superiority you get when you get upgraded to first class and you see people walking past you.
Oh, there's nothing better.
Turquoise. It's a terrible thing to feel in yourself, and you have to fight it back because you know you've been that guy walking to the back of the plane and you will be that guy again. But there's an immediate sense of, I deserve to be up here.
You are riffraff.
And people walking past me. Or just your ability to loathe and despise pedestrians when you're driving, and to loathe and despise drivers when you're walking. That us versus them thing comes out in us in all sorts of fun and weird places.
There's a guy I've known for a long time, and he was a smoker up until about his early 50s, and he quit smoking. And when he was a smoker, 70s, 80s, he was one of these guys, he was always complaining about, oh, we gave him a non-smoking section. Now they want the whole restaurant. Now we can't smoke on planes, and they tax this stuff, and blah, blah, blah. About 5 years after he quit, he was like, we should prohibit these things. We should get rid of them. I can't stand the smell of it. It's a disgusting habit. What's wrong with these people? What are they thinking? We shouldn't let these people smoke anywhere near the doorways, the buildings I have to go in. Just an absolute, 180. And I think that's unfortunately just part of who we are.
Yeah, my wife once saw this comedian. I'm trying to look up his name because we all know it. Used to write for the Weekly Standard every now and then. Larry Miller. Okay. Yeah, I think it was Larry Miller. You saw him playing in what are the Twin Cities? It's St. Paul and
Minneapolis.
And Minneapolis. So I guess my wife saw him in Minneapolis. Hmm. And I could be buttering this, but it doesn't really matter for the point of it. And he was doing a whole bit about how, whoever the comedian was doing a whole bit about how, they call us the Twin Cities and all this kind of stuff and blah, 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 blah. But we all know that if we could get away with it, we'd slaughter them all in their sleep over there in St. Paul. and it just always comes to mind every now and then about, how, every culture has their version of, we don't do Polish jokes anymore, but like, South Dakotans say North Dakotan jokes and Canadians say Newfie jokes. I mean, there's just this thing in us about that kind of thing. And of course,
there's a Lubbock Amarillo thing where I grew up. They're the only two cities of any consequence out there. And they both just look down on one another. They're identical cities. I mean, if you drop someone off who was born and raised in one and they didn't know they were in the other, it would take them a few hours to figure it out.
Well, it's like, my favorite line, one of my favorite lines from The Simpsons is where the Springfield kids led by Bart and Milhouse are in some sort of weird war with the Shelbyville kids. And they're both kind of chasing each other through the woods and whatever. And at one point Milhouse finds a candy wrapper on the ground and he picks it up and he goes, candy. Those Shelbyville kids love candy. They love it for the sweet, sweet taste, as if like, it's like some evil thing that only Shelbyville kids do. Anyway, Kevin, thank you so much for coming on. Again, roving correspondent, National Review, former colleague of mine, author most recently of Big White Ghetto. And stay warm, dude.
You too. If you can get out of Austin and get up to Dallas, I got a good guest room.
I appreciate it. I have many offers, but I just haven't been able to. I mean, the roads are truly dangerous, I have to say.
Yeah. Maybe a sled and a couple of horses.
Okay. So I've aged considerably since that conversation ended because I had to jump off the computer and deal with the fact that yet another one of my flights was canceled while I was recording that.
So I've lost count, but I've been canceled now, I think, 4 times on United and once on American. And now I'm rebooked and I have to drive to Houston because I no longer have any faith in the Austin airport ever being a portal to anywhere else in America. It is in effect, in terms of my confidence in it, it is on par with the Italian lira in the 1970s. I just have zero confidence in it whatsoever. But it's always good to talk to Kevin. You know, one point occurred to me that I didn't bring up, you know, where he was talking about the pressure of being a TV host and not wanting to sacrifice your tens of millions of dollars in income. I do think that's real, but knowing some of the people who are on TV, and knowing lots of people who really think it's hugely important to be on TV, I think the income stuff is just part of it. There are some people who just don't know how to be people who aren't on TV. And it has more to do with that status anxiety stuff than it has to do with money. You know, a great example of this is Larry King. Larry King, who recently died, he was once like the premier television talk show host in America, hugely influential. Everyone sat down with him. And rather than go off into retirement, he just kept doing whatever TV opportunities would afford themselves, because he didn't know how to be Larry King without being in front of a camera. So I don't know if he ended up on Russia Today or at the very end. I know he was on Russia Today for a while, or, you know, if he was on the George Foreman Grill Network or whatever it was, but he just, one of these people would just dry up and blow away if he wasn't on TV. And there are lots of those people out there. I mean, Hugh, I think his name is Hugh Downs. He used to be a big ABC reporter, and, you know, he does infomercials now. There are lots of these people who just think it's more important to be recognized in airports and the money is a secondary consideration. And I'm sure that the vast wealth stuff is a catalyzing thing on these other considerations, but I've just known too many people who think it's vitally important to be famous, and that's who they are, that I don't think it's just a financial thing, which I'm sure Kevin agrees with me. We got sidetracked by something else, and I thought I would bring it up because it's something I've thought a lot about. Anyway, I am truly exhausted, and I still have to write a column and figure out how I can get past the newly barbarized Boy Scout troops who are foraging for food in the frozen streets of Austin. I saw them take down, you know, an entire UT school bus thing and feast on bone marrow. It's hellish out there. I'm already contemplating wearing animal skins made from the various doodles and pugs that now live in this hotel. But hopefully it won't come to that. So, thanks to everybody who showed up for the Dispatch live event. If you were a member of the Dispatch community, you got to hear it, and you could replay the audio now and video if you wanted. You would get to see me in my my new barbarian sartorial splendor. And I think everybody is very lucky that there's no smell-o-vision on Dispatch live events. And I will figure out how to do the solo remnant tomorrow from someplace, somehow, somewhere, maybe in a snowbank with my daughter staring at me quizzically about why I am just saying these random things off into the ether as we slowly get buried or eaten alive or something. Anyway, I'm incoherent, but that's a feature, not a bug, of this fully functional podcast. So thanks for tuning in, and I will see you next time.
No, you won't. This is a podcast.
I'm Victoria Cash. Thanks for calling the Lucky Land Hotline. If you feel like you do the same thing every day, press 1. If you're ready to have some serious fun for the chance to redeem some serious prizes, press 2. We heard you loud and clear. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com right now and play over 100 social casino-style games for free. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.